It is now time for our main speaker. Please welcome Pat from Seal Beach.
Hi, everybody. My name is Pat Yo, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Gloria, for your talk and for driving. I'm 80, and I still have fun, so yeah. Just saying. I started drinking when I was 13. I was at a party. They were drinking, so I drank. I mean, I didn't, it was no big decision. I just wanted to fit in. And the magic happened. You know, I've always described myself as being really shy. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you call things by different names. You call that one self-obsession. I kind of prefer shy. It's like I can't help it, but I am self-obsessed. And I'm at this party and I'm feeling self-obsessed and I can't talk to anybody. I have no social skills whatsoever. And somebody handed me a rum and Coke and my life changed. The way I like to describe it is I feel like I relaxed that night for the first time in my life, really relaxed. I could talk to people at that party. I said funny things that made people laugh. I got up and danced and felt like the best dancer there, which I assure you I am not, but I felt like it. I just really felt like the life of the party. It was magic. I drank too much because that's what we do. And I blacked out and passed out and came to the next morning in bed with a Marine that I didn't know. Now, that was a lot more than I meant to do. The girls in my crowd were not behaving this way, and they knew how my evening had ended up. And I was embarrassed and ashamed. I was terrified I'd get pregnant. I had a lot of bad feelings the next day, but I drank again at the very next possible opportunity without even thinking about it. You know, apparently I was willing to pay the price from the gate. I was a periodic for a while, mostly because of my age. I didn't have immediate access to alcohol, but at every opportunity I drank. And when I was 15, I got a phony ID that said I was 35. And, I grew up in Newport Beach. There was actually a liquor store that sold to me on that ridiculous ID. That first night of drinking kind of set the tone for what my life behind drinking was going to look like. And that is when I drink, as I like to describe it, I become friendly. And so I developed a reputation in high school for being the friendly girl. And no girl wants that reputation. I certainly didn't. I knew people were talking about me and it made me feel bad. But I don't ever remember thinking, gee, maybe I shouldn't drink. And you know, these things might change. But that thought never crossed my mind. I drank, I got friendly, and people talked. My parents sent me away to boarding school for my last couple of years of high school because they were rightfully concerned about the direction my life was going. And I graduated high school successfully. I got married. I went to a local college and I got married at the end of that first year of college because somebody asked. I searched my heart over the years, hoping there was something deeper in there. But I remember we got married when I was 18 or I'm kind of old. I forget these. I think I was 18 when we got married. So I was 17 when he asked me. And I remember thinking, oh, thank God, I won't have to worry about that anymore. I was 17 years old. I mean, this is not over the hill by anybody's standards, but I have no self-worth. I didn't know any of these things about me. Any kind of insight you hear came after I got sober. Anyway, we got married and 6 months later, I left him. I said for years, well into sobriety, longer than I care to admit, that that I left him, I really didn't owe him amends because we both were just too young and immature, should never have gotten married. That all may be true, but when I was sober a good long while, I realized that I did owe amends for him. Here's why I left him. We were young married. Now, we drank when we were dating. I lived at home with my parents. He lived with his parents. We had little jobs, so we had money. We partied, we drank. Now, we're married, and we have bills to pay. And so what we would do for fun is we would get together with two or three other couples in one of our homes, and we would to play cards or board games or something, and we would buy one bottle of wine for 6 to 8 people. You understand what we're saying here? Yeah. We'd mix it with 7-Up to stretch it, and that's what we would drink over the course of an entire evening. I did not know that that was setting up a craving in me that wasn't being fulfilled. I didn't know anything about alcoholism, but it is very clear to me today that I left him because I needed to drink. Anyway, to move on, after we got divorced, I moved up to Los Angeles. I got a job in an apartment. It was really the first time in my life that I was on my own completely without a parent or a husband or nuns at the boarding school or somebody. And I became a daily drunk from the first day I moved up to LA. I was working as a secretary in a trucking company My parents were divorced when I was quite young, and my father was vice president of this company, which is how I got the job. And he was reluctant to hire me. I asked him, I had really good secretarial skills, but I'd never actually had a job. And it's hard when you're young to get the first job. And so I laid all that guilt on my dad, and he very reluctantly hired me. The agreement was I could have a job for a year and then I should move on. And it was a good opportunity. We'd have a solid year to put on a resume. So I went to work there, but I'm an alcoholic, and I behaved there the way I behaved in high school. Pretty soon, let's just say that I knew many of those truck drivers in the biblical sense, you might say. Apparently, they were talking about me there too, because my dad called me one day to talk to me about my behavior. I don't know about you, but I cannot even really think about what happened last night in the light of the morning. You know, I try not to think about it. I certainly cannot talk to my father about it. So I said some terrible things to him on the phone that day, just so he quit talking to me about it, which he did. We hung up, and I quit the job without going back to clean out my desk, because that's who I am. You know, I quit many. I never got fired from a job when I was drinking, but I quit every single job I had as a direct result of something that happened behind drinking. I have quit jobs more than one after office Christmas parties without going back to clean out my desk, because, you know, I've drank a lot of blackouts, and frankly, I'm grateful for it, because I remember enough to need more information. Here's how I drank. I went out with my boss and my coworkers one night, and we were bar hopping around downtown Los Angeles. And I think everybody was drunk in my little group there, but apparently I was a little bit drunker than the rest of them, because when we wound up in the strip club, I am the only one who auditioned for a job. It could have happened to anybody in this room, and probably did. But anyway, the stage was like here. We were sitting at this round table right in front of the stage, and I had excused myself from the table to go to the ladies' room, which was down the hall behind the stage. And I bumped into the owner of the bar in the hallway, and I made some derogatory remarks about the caliber of his entertainment. And he said something along the lines of, "Hey, if you think you're such hot stuff, go for it." Apparently, I thought that. So a moment ago, I was sitting at the table with my boss and my coworkers, dressed much as I'm dressed this evening. Moments later, I appear on the stage dressed in about this much clothing. And there was that moment when I happened to be looking at my boss the instant that he recognized who that was up there. I mean, it was like a moment. You know what I'm saying? This happened like well over 50 years ago. I mean, I can see the look on his face like it just happened a minute ago. It was such a clear moment. That's another job I quit without going back to clean out my desk. But, I mean, I was horrified the next day. A strip club, this is so tacky, I cannot believe I did such a thing. But it gave me ideas. Go-go dancing was kind of a thing at the time. I know when I said, I didn't just realize this a couple of years ago, and I've been telling this story for years. I think when I say go-go dancing, people of a certain age anyway picture like white boots and cute little, yeah, I didn't work in those kind of clubs. I worked in some real dives. But I went and got a paid job as a dancer. And I think I mentioned earlier, I'm not much of a dancer, but it didn't matter in these clubs, actually, whether you can dance very well or not. The first club I worked in and got paid for was a club on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles. I never met anybody there who spoke English. I don't have any idea how I got that job. But there I was, gainfully employed. Then I moved uptown after a little while to uptown because they spoke English in the next place. And this seemed like a good career move. The next place was on the outskirts of Chinatown in downtown LA, which is another way of saying it was on the outskirts of Skid Row, because they come kind of close together there. And I met the man who became my second husband there at Nick's, at this fine establishment where I was working. He was a customer who clearly, I have never been able to say it with a straight face. I tried to say who clearly recognized talent. I mean, it's... He was the most inappropriate man in the state of California for me. So of course we moved in together. We got married a little while later. We went to Las Vegas and got married by a judge who was wearing his bedroom slippers. It was a very romantic event. Now I'm married again, but in case there's any doubt in your mind, I'm a full-blown alcoholic, and even I kind of know it. I gave up show business, and I went back to working as a secretary. But I'm drunk every day. I'm calling my husband at 4 o'clock or so in the afternoon and saying, "Hey, I'm going to go out with the girls after work for a drink. I'll be, you know, half an hour late." I've never gone anywhere for a drink. I've turned down drinks if I know there's only going to be a drink, because I know I can't have a drink and stop. But I believed it when I said it to him on the phone. And of course, then I would maybe not come home, or I might come home missing an article or two of clothing, or maybe I would come home and everything was fine. I never knew. I never knew what was going to happen. So as you might imagine, it was not a very happy marriage. It just gets worse. You know, it just continues to get worse. My jobs were getting smaller and smaller. I peaked in my career when I was about 23. At that time, I was working as a legal secretary, making really, really good money for somebody that age, and clearly had a good future there. My last job, when I got sober, I was working as a clerk in a YMCA. And the primary part of the job was, if you were a member of that Y and you came in to pay your dues, I'm the person who wrote the receipt. And I was barely hanging on to that job. I was always hungover, often drunk on that job. I started getting arrested, and I can't believe this is happening to me. I'm just keeping an eye on the time here. My first arrest was on a Thanksgiving night. I'd been to Thanksgiving dinner at my parents' home in Newport. My husband wasn't invited. I don't think I mentioned my family was quite unhappy about this marriage. They actually never met him. They were that unhappy. So my husband was a chef at a restaurant in Beverly Hills. The owner of the restaurant had all of his employees to a Thanksgiving dinner at his house, at the boss's house. So my husband went to that. I went to my parents' house in Newport. I got very drunk at Thanksgiving dinner at my parents'. And I was driving home and I needed cigarettes. So I stopped at a bar. Where else would you stop to get cigarettes? It happened to be on Main Street in downtown LA, which is the heart of Skid Row. I cannot tell you why I picked that particular place to buy my cigarettes, but I did. I went in and drank some more there. And I came out of the bar later and I got arrested for common drunk on Main Street in downtown LA. They took me to Sybil Brand, which was the women's jail at the time. And they told me I could make a phone call. And I remembered where my husband was. So I called the boss's house. The boss's wife answered. I identified myself and told her I was in jail. Could she have my husband come bail me out? It did not occur to me that it might have been nicer to ask to speak directly to him to deliver that news. I never thought about anybody but myself, ever. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and heard you talk about making amends, I seriously sat in my chair thinking, gosh, no, I can't think of anybody I hurt. Oh my God, if I knew you 5 minutes, I probably hurt you. I am very selfish and self-centered. Anyway, you get the idea. I spent the last, I don't know, few 3 years maybe of my drinking pretty much drunk in a rocking chair in my living room in a purple flannel bathrobe. I had this little job that I mentioned to you that I was going to, but my life was terrible. I was in that business of trying to stop drinking on my own. It's clear even to me now that nothing good is ever going to happen here the way I'm drinking. So this isn't rocket science. I'll quit. Except I couldn't, you know. I'm suffering now from terrible hangovers. I can no longer drink truck drivers under the table, and I'm suffering terrible hangovers, and I'm filled with firm resolve in the morning. I'm not going to drink today, but I drank every day anyway. I could not stop. One hot summer day, I was sitting in my apartment. We lived in a second floor apartment. I could see into the neighbor's yard, backyard from where I sat, and they were a young couple about my age, late 20s, I think, and they had two small children, and the kids were playing in the sprinklers on the lawn, and the parents were sitting on the porch steps talking and laughing and watching their kids play, and I was drunk in my apartment watching them, and I cried because that's how I meant to be living my life. I don't know how this happened. I never, ever meant to be living like this, but I knew it was never going to change because I'd been trying to stop drinking, and I couldn't do it. I don't know how long it was from that day till the day I called AA, sometime between 3 months and 3 years. I'm really hazy on time frame references. I called AA one night. I was drunk when I called. Real nice man answered the phone at central office, and I found myself in my first meeting the next night. It was a big speaker meeting, maybe 350 people. I mean, it might as well have been 30,000 people, you know. And somehow I managed to get out of my car and go to the door, and there was a man standing at the door who put his hand out and said, "Hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." It made me feel welcome. I think it's the single most important thing anybody does in the meeting. I went in the room. It was an 8:30 meeting, so I got there at 8:28. And I didn't drink that day. The guy on the phone said, "Don't drink." So I'm like stark raving sober here. You know what I mean? And so by the time I finished shaking Clint's hand, I'm incapable of talking. I'm in the room. It's 8:29, and now everybody's milling around getting their seats. And a man came out of the crowd and asked me if I was new. And I couldn't imagine how he knew that, but I said yes. And He got me a seat in the back of the room and a big book. And it was a speaker meeting much like this one. And a man by the name of Norm Alpie spoke that night, and I heard him. We actually drank in one of the same places. Not at the same time. He was a much older man than I, but I identified. I believed he drank the way I drank. I believed he was sober. I believed he was a happy, joyous man. I could feel his joy clear in the back of this big room where I was sitting. I think that night I know what I got is hope. I believe maybe if I do, you kept saying, do what we do. I did not have a clue what that was, but maybe if I do what you do, I can stay sober, but I'll never feel the way that man feels. You can't get from here to there. But I got hope that night. I took the big book. I went home. That was a Saturday. I didn't drink again till Friday. I was impressed. AA works. This is phenomenal. Friday, I was drunk. And I went back to the meeting Saturday and raised my hand for being under a week of sobriety. And I got phone numbers the first night, but I didn't call you. I don't know you. What in the world would I say to you? One of these ladies sat down and talked to me a little while, and she gave me her number, and I called her the next week drunk. And she said, you might want to get a sponsor. You're not doing too well on your own. And I said, I don't know what that is or how to get one. And she said, I'll be your sponsor. She said, do you have a book? I said, yes. She said, bring it with you and meet me tomorrow night early before the meeting. We'll talk about it. I met her the next night. The first thing she did is she opened my big book to the front cover and told me to write that day's date in there. I wrote that date. She said, that's your sobriety date. I remember thinking, we maybe shouldn't have done this in ink. But I'm very happy to report that is my sobriety date, August 28, 1975, coming up on 50 years in August. The next thing she did was horrifying. She took the meeting directory and she circled the meeting for every night of the week. I said, I'm so sorry, I can't do that. I'm married, my husband isn't happy I'm at this meeting tonight. I definitely can't go to one every night. And she said, well, maybe you could do it with less, but not with me as your sponsor. She said something like, if you want me to be your sponsor, I assume it's because you want what I have. If you want what I have, I only know one way to get it, and that's to do what I do. And this is what I do. I believe the miracle for me happened in this conversation because I found myself agreeing to do what she was asking me to do. To be clear, newcomers, I didn't agree happily, and I didn't do it happily, but I did it, and that's why I'm still standing here sober. I tried to explain to her that, you know, that my husband was not going to like it. And she said, it doesn't matter if he likes it. It doesn't matter if you like it. I guarantee if you do it, your life's going to change. And so I started coming to meetings every night. By the way, I just want to say this. I believe in the broadest sense of the words, I took the first three steps that night when I essentially turned myself over to something greater than myself. I started going to meetings every night and taking these steps, and I was, cried all at every meeting I went to. I cried because my husband and I are arguing every night before I go to the meeting. He thought that I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to meet men. Now, I had noticed that there were men here, and I was not opposed to the idea of possibly getting better acquainted with some of you handsome fellows, but none of you seemed to be interested in me, which hurt my feelings quite a bit. And it really made me mad that my husband was accusing me of something that I was not actually doing right at that minute, you know? And so I felt I really honestly felt like I had the saddest life of anybody who ever came to AA. I was told to get to every meeting an hour early, not 55 minutes, 1 hour, and to have early commitments like chairs or cookies or coffee or something, and do my commitment and then circulate throughout the room and introduce myself to people and ask them how they are as though I care. And get phone numbers of three women that I don't already have. And then tomorrow, the day after the meeting, in addition to calling my sponsor, call these three people, women, whose numbers I got last night, just to be clear. A lot of newcomers here. So I would get to the meeting and I'd slam the cookies around in the kitchen or whatever my job was. And then I'd work the room and be like, hi, Gloria, how are you? And of course, she'd say something like, I'm fine, Pat, how are you? And I would tell her how I was with great wrenching, dramatic sobs, until her eyes would glaze over, and then, hi, how are you? And I did that for an hour until mercifully the meeting would start and we'd all get some relief from me. One night I was maybe 3 or 4 months sober. I learned the most important thing I think I learned right up to this minute. I was working the room as I just described, and I went up to this guy, Larry, and he asked me how I was, and I started to tell him with all my drama, and he cut me off in mid-sentence. He said, I don't want to listen to that. Why don't you go find a newcomer to talk to? Perhaps you'd feel better. And he pointed to a girl in the back of the room. He said, that girl over there in the red dress is at her very first meeting. Why don't you just march over and say hello? I clearly remember thinking, I do not care if the girl in the red dress lives or dies. I wish Larry would die. But I knew if I didn't do it, he was going to tell my sponsor. So this shouldn't take too long. I'll just dash over and say hello. So I went over with this resolve to help the newcomer. I went over and put my hand out and introduced myself. And the girl who had 12-stepped her, who I knew from the meeting, said, "Well, Pat, I've been waiting for you. This girl's first meeting, she had this big fight with her husband about coming to AA, and I knew you were the exact right person to talk to her." No, I'm possibly the worst person in the room. I fight with my husband every night about coming. I got nothing here. I didn't say any of this. It flashed in my head. I was sober 3-4 months. That was something, you know, but I couldn't, all I could see was how sad my poor little life was. But at that next instant, before I opened my mouth, I thought, you know, this girl is at her first meeting. I should try to say something positive here. And I heard myself say, "Keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time." Now I've just lied to a newcomer. I mean, it's just not cool. It's not getting better. But here's what happened to me that night. There was a center aisle. I know I didn't talk to this girl more than 30 seconds, probably. There was a center aisle like this. I was walking down that aisle, and I literally stopped dead in my tracks. I realized it was the first time in that hour period of time, from the time I hit the door of the meeting hall until the meeting actually starts, that I was there and I wasn't crying. And the reason I wasn't crying is for this brief 30 seconds, I thought of this newcomer, thought of something positive to say to her, and I felt better. It turns out, when I'm thinking about you, I'm not thinking about me, and I'm having a better day, and actually so is everybody around me, if that's the case, you know. I would like to tell you from that moment to this, I've happily worked with others, but that wouldn't be true. Actually, nobody was asking me to sponsor them, which hurt my feelings. All my peers in AA started sponsoring, you know, newer people. And I was, God, doesn't anybody want what I have? Well, would you ask the girl who cried for the whole meeting to be your sponsor? Probably not. You know, eventually I stopped crying and eventually started sponsoring people. It was clear to me that the problems in this marriage now are his fault. I'm working this spiritual program now. It can't be my fault anymore. And I wasn't exactly working a spiritual program at home, but I was staying sober and I was working my way through the steps. And it was inevitable that I would meet a man in a meeting who looked good to me, who looked back. I was 10 months sober. The gentleman in question was about 10 minutes sober. I saw him when he came through the door the first night. He had a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head. My heart started to pound. I leapt across a row of chairs, shoved that chair into the aisle to get close to him to introduce myself, and my sponsor noticed and did that thing that sponsors do, you know. And so I go over to my sponsor, and she said, "Pat, let's not forget you're a married woman." And I said, "Yeah, but I'm so unhappy." And she said, "Nonetheless, you're married, and I expect you to act married." I said, "I don't see this as a problem. I get divorced." And she said, "No, we in Alcoholics Anonymous don't think it's a good idea to make major moves in our first year of sobriety. Stay married, act married." Why would God get this guy sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? She didn't see it. His sponsor didn't see it either. You know, you can make almost anything happen if you want it bad enough. I was working at the time at a record company, at a record company in Hollywood, and he was working right down the street in Hollywood at a porn bookstore. You can't make this stuff up. You really can't. I arranged a long lunch hour at work for somebody to cover for me, and he didn't have a car either, so I picked him up at the bookstore, and we went to a motel, and let's just say we got to know each other better. And I dropped him up at the bookstore that afternoon. I was driving back to my office, and it occurred to me in the car that I was living exactly the way I'd always lived. I was 10 months sober, living exactly the way I had always lived, and I knew I was in a lot of trouble. I was scared to tell my sponsor what I had done because she had been very, very clear in her direction. But I don't want to drink. And so I told her that night what I did. And she said, "You know, Pat, I don't think you're a woman who could cheat on her husband and stay sober. And you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to." Well, here's the thing. I've never wanted to live that way, drunk or sober. I never wanted to be that person, but I am that person. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is this: wanting never changes a thing. My job in sobriety is to, when I have something like this, and for example, that I need to change, is to ask God for help, say a prayer and ask God for help, and then behave as though he has already given me that help. And so my sponsor and I talked over, and she said, "Just stay away from that guy. Day at a time, just stay away from him." I said, "Okay, I'll explain to him tonight what's happening." She said, No, stay away means stay away. I heard her. And I really heard that night for the first time for me, that line that is read in pretty much every meeting I've been to over all these years, half measures avail us nothing. I knew for me, this was going to be the big issue. I hate that word, but it would be the big issue that I would live or die off of, you know, and I knew that I needed to find a way to change or I was absolutely going to drink. And so I stayed away from him. The obsession passed, of course, because obsessions always pass. But the really good news is I don't live that way anymore. And just to be clear, because I've already told you my age, I haven't lived that. You're thinking, well, of course you don't, you're old. But so just to be clear, I haven't lived that way since I was 31 years old. And I never dreamed that that could happen. Never. I had the opportunity, my first sponsor drank, and I got a new sponsor right away. And she was sober a long time. And she said, you know, I've watched you whine and complain about your marriage. You owe a lot of amends to this guy. And the big book is really clear. You can't go home and confess infidelities he doesn't know about. That's not making amends. Making amends is about making things right. I would suggest to you that you start acting like a kind and loving wife a day at a time and see what happens. She gave me some specific things to do. I started watching couples in AA, how they treat each other. And we have good and bad examples here, but I tried to take the bad stuff home and practice it in my home. It sounds so easy when I'm up here talking about it, but this is one, it's like good day, bad day, you know, but gradually it got better. And one night I don't know how long I'd been doing that, a few months maybe. And I was on my knees thanking God for my sobriety. And I realized I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it didn't happen that day. It had already happened. It's the biggest problem in my life. And I didn't notice when it went away. Made a believer out of me. I got back down on my knees and I said something like, God, I believe if you mean for me to stay married to this man, I could do that and stay sober and have a happy life. Thank you so much. Not long after that, we found out that he had cancer. He was sick for a year and a half and he did die. It was a hard year and a half for sure, but it was also the best year and a half of our marriage because you all showed me how to do it, you know. I was so grateful that I had stayed when all of my best judgments said I should get out. When he died, I went to make some funeral arrangements at this little chapel and a couple of hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous took the afternoon off from work to be there. They didn't know him, but they knew me and they came to support me. And I realized that day that what my sponsor had promised me had 100% happened. I knew that I'd 100% made my amends to him. And I was so grateful that I had stayed. I remember thinking that's like the payoff, you know, for doing the work. But that's not even close. God's vision for me, and I assume for you too, is so much bigger than anything I can imagine on any given day. You know, after he died, I started dating some of the birthday people I think mentioned about actually going on a date. My husband, Vince, who my third and final husband, as I like to say, is the first person I ever actually went on a date with. But up till then, every relationship I ever had was we meet, we have sex, and then maybe embark on a relationship. Vince had been my friend for three years in Alcoholics Anonymous. We started dating, we fell in love and got married, and he was a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we had a really good run together. We were together almost 30 years. He died a number of years ago now. I know that I would not have had the kind of happy marriage with Vince that it was if I hadn't learned the tools there with my former husband. You see what I mean about God's vision? I didn't know that that's what was happening. You know, I just did what the next indicated thing was, you know, and my life has turned out in such a wonderful way. I'll just talk a little bit about God and say this. I've always believed in God, that it's sort of an abstract, you know, yeah, there's a God. Certainly never felt any kind of a connection to any God. When I was new, my sponsor said, get on your knees in the morning and at night, ask him to keep you sober, thank him for keeping you sober. I did that. I never felt a connection. I just did it. I worried, do you hold your hands like this? Do you hold them like this? But if my husband walks in the room and sees me, he has seen me falling down, disgusting drunk, but God forbid he should see me praying. You know what I'm saying? We are so twisted. Anyway, as time went by, I started to feel it a little bit, you know. And then I started, I heard somebody say this, and I absolutely believe it to be true. The more I'm seeking God, the closer I'm going to get to him. And that has been my experience. I've had these sort of wonderful spiritual experiences that let me know. I mean, I believe absolutely God is everywhere all the time. He's there when I'm doing dishes or whatever, you know. But there's those moments when you know it, you know, you really know it. I'll just tell you about a couple of them because I like talking about them. couple of years ago, I live in Seal Beach, and a couple of years ago, I was down at the beach. It was winter time, and so it was very chilly, and there, so there was nobody there. I took my beach chair, and I had a jacket on. I sat, you know, near the water and just was kind of meditating and taking some pictures with my phone of the pier. And there was one guy on the beach, maybe about as far as from here to the door, maybe not quite that far from where I was sitting, and he was doing Tai Chi. And that's kind of a cool thing to watch. You know, I'm meditating and watching him do his Tai Chi. It's all cool. And when he finished, he held his hands up to the sky. And in the sweetest voice, he sang the Lord's Prayer. I had my phone in my hand and I started to hit record. And then I thought, no, I don't think so. I don't think this is a record moment. This is a spiritual thing happening here. I cried when he was singing. And I know if I had recorded that, I would have played it once or twice. It wouldn't have felt, you know, the same, and then it would be forgotten. But every time I tell that story, I can feel it, you know, I can. So that moment stays with me. Another time, at one point, Vince and I lived in Pasadena, and for me to get to work, I had to drive down the Pasadena freeway, past Dodger Stadium, through downtown LA, and circle around to my office. And it's Los Angeles traffic, you know, it's terrible. And so every morning I'd get to a little ways before Dodger Stadium and the traffic would slow almost to a complete stop. We would be going 2 miles an hour for the next, you know, till we got around the curve. And I'm like a crazy person in the car. I'm clutching the steering wheel. I'm cursing God and every other person on the road. I'm in this lane and I think, oh, that lane's better. And then, whoops, no, it was that one. I'm that person. You know, I was just insane on the road every morning for at least a year. I'm only admitting to a year. Until one day I'm in the car, I'm driving to work, I get to that spot, the traffic slows, I'm all tensed up, and I happen to glance over to the right. Down the embankment of the freeway is Figueroa, and across Figueroa is a bar that I worked in as a dancer. I just came from a really nice house in Pasadena where the mortgage is current. There's a husband there who loves and respects me. I'm in a decent car here. I'm going to a secretarial job where they think I'm great. When I get off work this afternoon, I'm going to go to an AA meeting. I'm going to see my sponsor and a couple of women that I sponsor. I'm going to enjoy a good AA meeting. And when that meeting's over, I'm going to go home with my own husband. I am not the woman who did the things that I did in that parking lot behind that bar. You can't get from down there to up here in this car, yet here I am. I started to cry in the car that day. I was so grateful for my life. It was the last time I cursed the traffic. I used to look forward to getting to that spot. I remember one day it was a holiday or something, but I had to work and there was like really light traffic and we kind of whizzed by there and I was mad, you know, because I want my moment. I've had so many moments. How much time do I have left? Okay, so I will tell this story because I love it. After Vince died, my husband died, I moved out to Palm Desert and I lived there for 10 or 11 years before I moved back to Seal Beach. And I have always been what you would refer to as a couch potato. I've never really done much exercise. I've had good intentions, but it never went anywhere, you know. But now I'm retired from my job and I'm single. My husband's gone and there's really no excuse for not doing something. You know, I have no excuse anymore. So I started just going for little walks. And a friend of mine in the program, a girlfriend in the program, who is a major backpacker, said to me one day, "Have you ever heard of the Camino de Santiago?" And I said, "No, I have not." But you can tell the people who have by the expressions on their faces. I said, "No, I have not." And she said, "I want you to Google it and read about it and then call me and let's talk." And so I Googled it and I called her and I said, "I want to do this." The Camino de Santiago, for those of you who are not familiar, is a spiritual pilgrimage in Spain. It's a 500-mile walk. You actually start in southern France. You cross the Pyrenees Mountains the first couple of days and then go all across northern Spain to Santiago, where to the cathedral in Santiago, where allegedly the bones of St. James are buried. I think if you're Catholic, that's important. I don't happen to be, but it started as a Catholic pilgrimage hundreds of years ago and has evolved over the years into a pilgrimage for people of all faiths. And so anyway, I said to Linda, "I want to do this." And she said, "Okay." She said, "It's 500 miles, Pat. You're going to have to train." And she said, "I'll train you." And I said, "Okay, great. We're planning to do it a year from the date that we're having this conversation." So we go out for my first day of training. In my defense, it was a very hot day. and we lived in the desert. I think we, in retrospect, it was about a 2 mile walk. And we're not quite back to the car. The car is about where the last row is back there. from where we are. I'm done, though. I can't. There's this big rock. I'm sitting on this rock. I've got my head between my knees. I've drunk all my water, all her water. I'm whimpering. And she kept saying, Pat, the car's right over there. I can see. It's right there. I said, I know. I can't. Eventually, she got me up off that rock. Oh, she's quite a photographer. And she took a picture of that moment of me on the rock. And I had that on my refrigerator for a long time because I love what it led to. Anyway, long story short, a year later, I found myself laying in a little hotel in southern France, looking out the window. We're going to start tomorrow on our trek. There's this terrible electrical storm going on in the mountains. And I don't mean just a little bit of lightning. I mean lightning. We're going to die tomorrow, clearly. She's quite the photographer, so she's just going, oh, it's so beautiful. We got up the next morning at dark 30 and started out. And the third day, we'd gone about 14 miles that morning, and we had stopped to rest and, have a little something to eat by the side of the trail there. And we're refreshed, and we get back up, and we start off, and she's a little bit ahead of me, and I said to her, you know, I can't believe that I'm doing this. I can't believe that I trained hard enough to do this. I can't believe that I overcame all kinds of fears about doing it. Yesterday I was in France. Today I'm in Spain. I don't speak either language. You know, there's a lot of fear associated with all of this. This is the most fantastic thing that has ever happened to me. About 5 minutes later, I fell down a steep, rocky hill on my face and wound up had to hike another 2 or 3 miles to get to Pamplona, and then wound up in an emergency room. And the long and short of it is the pilgrimage ended. Her niece actually drowned that same day at home. And so both of us, she would have gone on without me, which we had agreed ahead of time, you know, whatever. So we both wound up coming home together. It was a very sad, sad trip. I remember the guy at customs, you know, the guys at customs, they're like very, look up and stamp, look up and stamp. He looks up and goes, Jesus, what happened to you? Because my face is all. We got home and all my friends said things like, oh, Pat, I'm so sorry. You didn't get your spiritual experience. Yeah, I did. I had it there about 5 minutes before I fell. You know, I should have known this. You can't plan a spiritual experience. You can't say on October 30th, when I get to Santiago, I'm having a spiritual experience. They don't work that way. You know, God shows up when he shows up. And he has shown up for me big time over the years. I love being sober. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank you so much for having me.